Okay, Stephen, I don't want the answer to the question. I want us to talk about changing the world instead of models.
Right.
Could we do that?
Absolutely.
Let's have a conversation about changing the world.
Let's have a conversation about changing the world.
All right, so I'm going to ask you, do you want to answer that question? Do you want to hear the answer to the question?
The answer is that you could tell a difference between a novice economist and Robert if you put their two brains in the scanner and asked each of them economics questions. But which would be the wiser, I'm not sure.
Very good. There you are. I knew that would be the answer. Okay. Because I've been listening, I really want to talk to you because I think it's really important. And I think it's important for Robert, so just while he's still here.
Has he gone or is he still
there? No, he's there. He and Marcus de Sotoy had an exchange. Marcus said it, actually, but I'd really love to hear you say something about it. It's really about scientific responsibility, and therefore, in a way, it'll take us into general moral responsibility.
Sure.
Because I just was getting a bit about it's all doing it without us, and all we can do is go, and if we get very, very rich, we go, oh, I'm very, very rich. And if we're poor, we go, oh, I'm very, very poor. Marcus said that going into a hedge fund was just like, it was fun, and it was just like going into a maths department. It was really relaxed, and they were just doing their thing. It rang a sort of incredible bell with me because of something I've been reading stuff about my own father, Jacob Bronowski, going into Hiroshima and Nagasaki. At the behest of the English and American governments in November 1945, August, September, October, 3 months after the dropping of the bomb, to assess the damage. Now, he had worked on saturation bombing as a mathematician. Mathematicians, again, all those jolly mathematicians, of whom, you know, you and I could name half a dozen,
indeed, had
worked for the British government on how best to create the firestorm at Dresden, how best to... they had worked on the fun of mathematics. And then what I've now got is the letters my father wrote back from Hiroshima to my mother about the enormity of going and seeing what the fun you did in your mathematics, department
yes.
produced. And so I kind of wanted to jump up then and say to... say to Robert and Marcus,
we weren't allowed to interrupt,
because they're not dead bodies all
yes.
over the place.
Yes.
Well, actually, there were a few. Why is it allowed still to be fun when calamities happen as a result of hedge fund mathematics, when we all understand that it isn't fun when it's saturation bombing? There you are. That's your question.
I think that's an extraordinarily important question. And just to pick up, first of all, on the example of Jacob going into Hiroshima and Nagasaki in that sort of way, those radical scientists of the 1930s, people like Bernal, people like Blackett and so on, actually took an enormous amount of energy and efficiency in actually inventing better weapon systems.
Yeah.
Haldane, yeah. Member of the Communist Party, distinguished geneticist, incredibly enthusiastic about chemical weapons. One of the, J.D. Bernal was a hero of mine,
yeah.
and one of the more alarming things that I discovered not so long ago was that he was in some ways the inventor of fragmentation bombs.
Yeah.
Now this is, I can well see that back in the late 30s and during the war against Nazi Germany, that actually every scientific muscle was actually yeah. strained to try and produce those things, but also, there is a tremendous excitement about solving a problem. There's no question about mm-hmm. it. I mean, when I'm in the lab, I'm excited, I'm enthusiastic, I design an experiment. I always say to my starting students, the second most exciting thing you can do as a researcher is to design an experiment to test a hypothesis. All the technology works, which is actually very rare, at least for the first or second or third time you do it, and the experiment comes out right and the hypothesis has been proved. That's brilliant. But the really first most exciting thing is the experiment turns out right and the hypothesis is disproved, because then you've got to think like hell. And then you've got to go through to have what people have been talking about earlier, earlier in some of the discussions between Bonnie and Mark and so on, the aha moment in which you actually finally understand what went wrong and why, how stupid you were that you didn't actually solve this problem before. Now, that's exciting. It's the sort of excitement that makes a career in science or a career in creativity of any sort of way the most marvellous thing that you can do, because it's work and it's fun, and if you're paid for it, then that's absolutely great. But it actually also closes you off from the implications of what you're doing. And that's why I passionately believe that one of the problems that we've got at the moment is that we're only good as a society at beginning to grasp consequences of actions when they're what's called downstream. The end-of-pipe solution, that we see there's an environmental crisis, we have to solve it. What we have to do is to find some way of getting upstream, of getting a proper democratic accountability of what science is doing, what technology is doing, what everything else is doing in our society, upstream, before the consequences come and hit us like a sledgehammer, and it's too late to try and resolve them then. Now, of course, in a sense, that's part of a responsibility that you're faced with sort of routinely in the ATFA, is it not?
Yes, I mean,
and I'm not sure I'm happy with some of the decisions you've made. But
that's absolutely fine. In fact, this is the Human Fertilisation Embryology Authority that I chair, and of course I don't, as it were, exactly make the decisions. But I think we could move there. But in a way, I'd rather move there indirectly, because only because I'm thinking, you know, you've taken us to that, you know, the aha moment. I've always thought. I mean, I started as a mathematician myself, that I've always thought it's most sort of extraordinarily captured by mathematicians, because their problems are so pure and the solutions are so elegant, if they are solutions, and the non-solution is also, you know, exciting. I think other fields of science, maybe your own, don't have as many aha moments. But what I wanted to ask you, although I'm going to talk myself, but see, I'm really good at interviewing other people, okay, so in the lab, you're isolated, but you're a political activist, so you know that when those outcomes are handed over to all those dreadful people Robert was talking about, making decisions based on models and, I mean, those were economists, but I mean, governments, they, when they're handed over there, then responsibility seems to be on the back burner. Oddly, in your scientific lab, there's quite a lot of responsibility, I think, in responsibility. You hand your stuff over to the party politics or the sectarian interests or the large institutions and machines, and they then use them, apply them in ways which allow people to say, it wasn't my fault, Gov, it was the system, it was this thing that they gave us, that, you know, was the biggest megawatt bomb anybody had ever made. All we did was work out where it ought to be used and then drop it. Really, it wasn't our fault.
Well, that's the Eichmann defence, isn't it? I'm just a cog in a machine.
Yeah.
And what we've got to do, it seems to me, is to recognise two separate things. Firstly, that we may be cogs in the machines. We're cogs which can act. We can jam up the system if we want to.
Yeah.
We can break a cogwheel.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, there is the global, broader responsibility. So it's no good talking about Hippocratic oaths for scientists and so on, as if the global thing wasn't actually there.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, there really isn't much, quote, pure science in that sense, in that sense that you're talking about pure maths.
Mm-hmm.
When G.H. Hardy used to toast, here's to mathematics, which has no conceivable use for anyone at all. You know the phrase better than I do. There's no way that in the lab what we're doing is like that at the moment. Firstly, because what we do is business.
Mm-hmm.
It costs 1-3% of GDP. Mm-hmm. We have to get the money to do it, and the money to do it actually depends upon the priorities of the funders, government, military, big pharmaceutical companies, sometimes the charities as well. So all of that constrains what we do. And of course then the whole nature of doing university research has shifted, certainly in the biosciences, where many of my colleagues, at least successful ones, either have their own startup companies, they have patents, they're directors, they're this, they're that, they're the other. And in a sense, the idea that there is an academic life which is separate from the downstream consequences of what you're doing is almost not there anymore. In fact, some people suggest there is more freedom to explore ideas in large commercial laboratories and pharmaceutical companies than there is in the universities anymore. So the situation is very different. We can't go back to where we were 20 years ago. We have to find a way of moving forward and finding new forms of actually achieving that sense of responsibility and control.
But doesn't it hinge on our all accepting that our personal, I mean, it's that dreadful sort of residual Thatcherite individualism, you know, that are all accepting, A, that we have responsibility, and climate change, that change, that's absolutely obvious, and young people are bloody good at it. It's me who won't sort my rubbish and can't be bothered to walk down, you know, because I think it's only me, it won't matter. You know, younger people fully understand that there's no such thing as only me. There's you as part of a collective sense of responsibility.
I hope that's right. Yeah. I mean, I hope that's right. We had a me generation very strongly during the last 20 years or so, and if that's beginning to shift in terms of environmental responsibility, then so much the better. But actually, it's not going to affect your or my generation in the way it's going to affect the younger generation. If they don't do it, then why the hell should we? But if they are doing it, then we should. I mean, I suppose it doesn't mean too much to sign up to this 10-10 thing, and we're all going to turn our lights off and drive less and so on, and be green, when we know the global problem is much greater than that. The danger is to actually say, I'm doing my thing by turning the lights off or by recycling my rubbish, without recognising that the global problem is much greater than that, and that what one's doing is more or less symbolic.
Well,
sure, one should do it.
I think that the young, I don't know why I'm calling the young, but the sort of students that I come in touch with in the 2 days a week that I'm still teaching in the university, I think they understand both those things, right? I think they understand both those things, and therefore I think we owe it to them, you know, even in discussions like this, to be engaging with the two problems simultaneously rather than focusing on the big insoluble problem. I mean, the big insoluble is the big insoluble. I mean, you know, you can ask me whatever you like about regulation of infertility.
You weren't going to let me to.
No, you can now. You can now. Because I've had the answers to my question, right? I'm really, really happy for you, because, you know, coming from somebody in the biological sciences, it's really interesting to me. You know, I'm the lay chair. You just have to remember I'm the lay chair.
I do understand that.
Go on, you ask me.
Okay, but, I mean, it's worth just spelling out what the ATFA actually regulates at the moment.
I am in charge, right? Now, you have to understand I have two personalities, one in the long conversation and one my official capacity. In that official capacity, I am in charge of all frozen sperm in the United Kingdom. And as my hairdresser says, I'm not having ice in my drink in your house. So the HFEA, or EFA, as it is occasionally known, is the regulatory body, a quango, arm's length body, which oversees the licensing of every single clinic in the United Kingdom, throughout the United Kingdom, that carries out assisted reproduction of any kind, but mostly IVF. And that is including NHS and private. 85% of it is private. So that's really, really interesting. We regulate the private sector, right? Has a little bit of an influence over how hard we can...
But then that's the regulation of existing techniques. But then there is the development of things like stem cells, human-animal chimeras.
Well, in the sense that we administer the law, well, that's all we can do. I mean, we don't make the law, we administer it. And there's a new legislation which comes on stream on the 1st of October. So the licensing of clinics, so it's interesting because that includes the future promises.
Administering the law might be rather like saying it weren't me, Gav.
All right, then let me say that what I find exciting about it, I really love it, I absolutely love it, it's the most intellectual thing that I do, including my university work, is that we have a policy, we are both policy formers and policemen, if you like. The policy forming, you are absolutely right, involves our, when we are challenged by, let's say, research laboratories working on stem cells or wishing to work on stem cells. Research laboratories, the infamous one is wishing to produce human admixed embryos. That is to say, they used to be called...
chimeras.
No, worse than that. They used to be called, what did they used to be? Anyway, so, and we had to have this sort of cleaned up name for them, which is an animal egg, which is a cow or a pig, because they're closest to us genetically, from which you remove the nucleus and you insert human DNA. And they're only used in laboratory for laboratory purposes, except actually nobody's got a license at the moment. I mean, nobody has a grant at the moment to use them. They're only to be used in the laboratory, and the sole reason that ultimately our policy moved towards allowing them to be created is because women's eggs, human eggs, are in such scarce supply that it is out of the question to do that process to a human egg in the laboratory, because all human laboratories are needed, human eggs are needed.
But what interests me here is, firstly, the regulatory regime in Britain is much lighter than it is in most other European countries. So the rush to do stem cell research in Britain, to use women's eggs in this sort of way, has actually, I think, produced... I mean, I suppose I'm a Kantian about this, and that is, I think it uses women and it uses human embryological material as a means, not an end. But as, apart from the philosophy, what worries me about it enormously is that in the normal run of things, in the way that one does research, you start with animal experiments and then you move into humans. Now, the overwhelming set of problems that all this hype about stem cells has actually produced means that the technical problems which you would normally solve in animals have not actually been solved. So why are we working with human material which produces all these ethical issues? And produces what a lot of people say, feel very uncomfortable about, even for things we can't articulate about human-animal chimeras, when we haven't solved the problems in animal experiments as well.
I absolutely agree, but the blunt answer is nobody is at the moment, probably for those reasons. That is to say, we do what, as it were, is necessarily in well, actually the law from October the 1st will allow, as you know, the creation of human admixed embryos, but we do what is required for the law both to make sense and, you know, as we understand it, over a long duration, fits with what the research laboratories hope to be able to do. But ethics committees and grant-giving bodies, hey presto, do not then grant the permission to do it, right? So I actually think it's an area where there are enormous numbers of checks and balances. And when you say we are very light touch, as a regulator, everybody needs to understand that that is only in relation to research, scientific research, which obviously you're most interested in. We're regarded as incredibly tough in relation. Actually, our first, in terms of our charter, our first obligation is patient safety in IVF clinics, in clinics, in assisted reproduction. So this is, in some ways, a rather extraordinary extension of our powers, which people like Josephine Kintavali in the House of Lords insist ought not to be within our powers. We've got them. That's where the government's put them. But as I say, if we're light touch there, well, now that Obama's changed the law in America, it's a great deal lighter touch over there.
Well, it's been a lighter touch there.
One of
the peculiar features about this is that the American legislation only applies to money given by the American government. It doesn't apply to what the private industry is doing.
Yeah.
But it does raise to me, I mean, apart from the technicalities of this, for this discussion, a much more general issue of the way that as political decisions are made which press research to go in particular directions, in which, I mean... Take the famous government consultation a few years ago on GM foods, and they attempted to take it out to town meetings around the country and so on and so forth. And the overwhelming response they came back is that people don't want GM.
Yeah.
So the government's response was, well, it's the wrong sort of people who've responded.
They said that when we marched for the Iraq war as well.
Yeah, it really does go back to that statement that Bertolt Brecht made, all those when the East Germans were rising against the communist government in East Germany in 1953. in which Brecht said the government has lost the confidence of the people, the government must elect a new people. And this is precisely yes. what is being yeah. done in a lot of this sort of research.
Okay, but could we do it? Could we get back to some questions that
go on? Okay.
I mean, I'm happy with that being a big issue.
Yeah.
I'm really comfortable with how it's going where I am, and I'd love you to come in and look at it. As I say, you know, the extremes of currently of human of stem cell research, which uses human embryonic tissue, is actually in very small amounts for many of the reasons that you're talking about, and good for that. And of course, you know why there's so little. All right, this is just to round off. I hope the idea that we really have to think in one piece about science and the technologies that it and the government pressures that you're talking about to work in particular directions. The law does indeed allow the creation of admixed embryos. It does indeed allow the creation of embryos for research. No, the use of embryos for research purposes, but only for 14 days. And nobody's...
That's because they can't keep them alive.
I was going to say that. See, I knew that much. They can't keep them alive past three. So, but it isn't only that. It isn't only for that reason. That was something that that was decided very early on.
It was the Warnock Committee.
It was the Warnock. It went right back to the Warnock Committee. Bless it. But the reason that the research is not going on is because the law also says that no tissue thus created can be reinserted into a human being, right? None. And so, guess what? Has no commercial value to the clinics. The clinics are not interested because clinics that charge between £3,000 and £8,000 a cycle for IVF only want advances in technology they can use. And so, lo and behold, that's not being done, right? Another question that I could ask you, see, about why my husband has acute psoriasis, why nobody does any bloody research on skin, because it's so, there's no money in it.
Well, for those of anyone who suffered from psoriasis, I think you're absolutely right. But then there's also all sorts of areas of research, particularly as, I mean, the outstanding feature is, of course, malaria research in third world countries. Where the money isn't, then the big pharmaceutical companies don't go.
Yeah.
And that's one of the huge problems one's actually got to resolve.
So where in this process are we going to intervene? Because you do a lot of intervention.
Well, we try to.
Yeah.
One tries to. And it goes back to...
So you're a real-life activist and scientist. Yeah, there ain't many of those about.
Well, we're a dying breed. Perhaps we need to be cloned. That would deal with it, wouldn't
That's
it?
Well, all right. I'll license it. I'm licensing a Stephen Rose clone. You heard it first here.
Perish the fool.
Maybe we'll clone Hillary.
For those who don't know, Hillary is my sociologist partner with whom we do a lot of work together, but who is not here today. But yes, I mean, it comes back to the issue of what can one do. One can do what Robert was talking about before, that is, you can communicate, you can inform. But I don't believe there is, so to say, an eye of God, a pedestal on which you stand as a scientist and which you can form, as if there is something which is objective truth, which is separated from yourself and separated from the culture and the society in which you live. It's not that, to come back to a discussion I think before you came in, which I think was probably between Bonnie and Mark Lithgow, which was talking about counterposing science and culture. As you know better than almost anyone else, science is part of culture.
Yeah, but you can't, yes.
You cannot do that.
No, but thank God you can't, because thank God you can't. But that being the case, then it is about where the trigger points are going to be in our own understanding. And I think that does have to be, well, it can be collective, but Robert said something about having a belief, which I suspect he got either in the womb or in the nursery, of believing that education will ultimately, that it is education that will take people forward so that they have the understanding to make the changes that are necessary for humanity. Now, I used to think that. I mean, I still think it, otherwise I wouldn't still be teaching. I still think it, and I think it for this very specific reason, is it is only that that avoids whole populations being sucked into dogma or sucked into totalitarianism. It is absolutely the autonomy of your own thought process that allows you, I believe, it's only about, you're a neuroscientist, but it's not enough to trigger the moves that would be still community moves.
I mean, we are educators, and you're educators in some senses into our bones, and and we can't help being that. And we were involved in setting up the Open University way back in 1969, at the very beginning of the university. I've been there for the last 40 years. Our view, particularly amongst the scientists creating the science syllabus, is that old Baconian one: knowledge is power.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And if you want to democratize power, you have to democratize knowledge.
Yes.
Yes, you have to do that, but it's not enough,
no,
as we recognize now. Because you can democratize knowledge all you like. You can have a blogosphere, this entire world of people tweeting and having social interactions and so on, and Robert's blog and any other blog that you write. But unless there is a way of actually achieving consensus and changing things, then that's just in danger, it seems to me, of being steam.
Yes.
And that worries me enormously. Actually, for any of us who've actually sort of been the victims of the blogosphere, the sort of things that it unleashes in terms of sort of the freedom of people to write sort of the most disgusting stuff.
Yeah.
Is really quite disturbing.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to be disturbed by that, because I'm a technomaniac. Largely because absolutely everybody in my family is in the IT business.
Avoid it.
No, but the thing is, you know, most of the web is pornographic as well, but we don't look at those bits.
Yeah.
And indeed in the world, well, I always say, the example I always give, because I think it kind of reassures people, is that, you know, I work on the 16th century on archival materials, and for a long, long, long time I thought they were all clean. And then when I kind of started, finally, when I was kind of grown up, you know, which meant I was about 45, I finally discovered there were as many dirty books, you know, printed by the early presses, as there are, you know, pornographic sites on the internet now. It's just you don't encounter them unless that's what you're looking for. Maybe the other example would be that, you know, most of the web is in Chinese or Russian or other language, but we only see the English bit, you know, the English language bit. So I think, I do actually think that the blogging is empowering, but we haven't yet figured out how. Because yesterday, I'm sure other people read it, you know, a book shot up 200,000% on Amazon because Stephen Fry mentioned it on Twitter. You know, now that's actually very interesting, that the power of 140 characters or whatever it is to alter unexpectedly, of course, being Stephen Fry, it's sort of a ridiculous book that actually nobody probably does want to read, but you know, it's now gone into a reprinting. So there, I'm sounding facetious. You know, the climate camp in Deptford for the last summit was brilliantly created by the use of blogs and Twitter. Now, if you can do that, you ought to be able to think seriously about how to bring people together in groups that are not perfectly aligned anymore with nations or social background or... do you see what, you know, and that, I think that, again, somebody said in the last conversation, isn't it curious, maybe it was you, isn't it curious that nationalism is on the rise just when everything is global and nation states have no power? But that's absolutely why those things happen, because the more frightened people are of the bigger scale, the more totally they turn in and become obsessive about the small scale. If it is possible for the internet to do anything about teasing that apart, so that in the good old Marxist, you know, I'm old enough, I was once a Marxist, you know, that, you know, that, 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 you know, that the proletariat was not national, it was international, and that was what gave it its power, and we're back to that again.
Sadly, it was one of the big flaws in Marxist theory.
Well, no, it's a good idea.
Well, it was great, but it was exploded with the Zimmerwald conference, which was supposed
See,
to...
See, he was a Marxist too. Until
indeed
he...
I was. Indeed I am, in some senses.
Yes,
in the sense that I recognise that Marxist analysis actually sort of has a great deal of power to it, just misses certain things. Like it misses gender, like it misses nationalism, like it misses racism. And if Marx had been right, the First World War, let alone the Second World War, would never have happened. Unfortunately, he was wrong.
Well, all right, let's not dwell on the let's just take the analogy that the idea that we might be able to create groups that could concentrate on an issue like a specific, I mean, Arundhati Roy sort of did it when she used the power of having won the Booker Prize to bring to the attention of a world that had no understanding the enormity of destruction by dam building.
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, in a particular location that I hadn't heard of until she wrote about it. But we can't, and all the time I've been in this room, we've talked as if it's all hopeless. I don't think it's hopeless at all. I think we've just got to figure it out.
I think we've got to go on living as if it's not hopeless. I mean, it's a pessimism of the intellect and it's an optimism of the will.
I hope you're an optimist.
It's absolutely crucial.
No, I'm not.
I'm not supposed to talk to anybody else. But
it's absolutely crucial we actually maintain the belief that we have to be able to, we have to stop things getting worse and make things get
I think it's
better.
Actually criminally irresponsible to be a pessimist. I just think it is, because particularly if you're very highly educated and a practitioner in a very advanced field, whether it's economic theory or neuroscience, right?
Well,
thank you.
I'd like to go along with that. On certain things I am extremely optimistic, it's perfectly true. In terms of the advances in neuroscience, I'm optimistic. In terms of whether the human race will survive the next century, then I think that it's up for debate, but I'm prepared to do whatever I can to try and actually prevent that.
You're almost as bad as Lord Rees on that one, and that's really saying something.
Well, I was quoting Martin Rees in this respect.
It's not true, anybody. It's not true.
No.
The wonderful that all right. Tell me whether you can make a case. Forget your own pessimism. You're a neuroscientist, and actually you told me that you thought, which I was interested in, that because the brain is... Oh, now I'm going to ask you a question you can't answer because it's going to be the end.
The god's going to go
in the middle.
Yes.
All right, you can tell me afterwards. But that if neuroscience... If you are saying our brains are adapting, if only by, as it were, exercise and practice...
Absolutely.
Well, then I see no reason not to believe that they might adapt sufficiently for us to be able to solve the problems that lie ahead of us.
Well, that's if it were left to individual brains, that might be the case. But there's a little matter of society and the global economy, which goes in there as well.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm optimistic about those. So that's all right. So as long as you tell me the brain is developing, that's absolutely fine.
Well,
and it's not what Susan Greenfield thinks, so thank heaven for that.
No, I'm...
She's a very good friend of mine.
Shall we? But we do have to accept that, as it were, as technology advances, you and I are what they call digi-immigrants, as opposed to the digi-natives who can actually program a Blackbird or a BlackBerry.
A BlackBerry. Are you telling me you think I can't do that?
I'm telling you, you have to learn it very
no,
hard.
Insulting. Yes. No, it's very easy, right?
Well, maybe you're a digi-native.
No,
too.
Women are just better at these things than men.
You're the secret of it. Because you've got little neat fingers.
We've got neat fingers and we can multitask. And both those things are necessary to use an iPhone. Who'd use a BlackBerry anyway?
Yeah, absolutely true. It's entirely to do with your right hemisphere, if you actually believe in neuroscience of 30 years ago, which is no longer believed to be the
quite
case.
Right. All right. Well, I think I'm going to have to reprogram you to be an optimist.
Well, I will work on it, I promise you. Every day, in every way, I will get more and more optimistic.
But okay, all right. Shall I ask you another huge question? Then we can... No, I won't.
You won't ask me any more questions.
No, but I will say something before, since the gong is going to be...
I will ask you a question.
Yes,
which
do.
Which you can answer after the gong has gone again.
Yeah.
And that is, I mean, you are not merely a multitasker, but you're a polymath. You actually sort of write about everything from history. You do the ATFA. You have a huge range of actually tasks. How do you actually organise your time? I don't actually think it's almost feasible.
No, that it's an illusion. It's smoke and mirrors, and I sleep very fast.
In which case, everything is on your side, and you did manage to answer the question
even before the gong went.
Were actually available.
No, it is an illusion. Actually, I don't really. I was ill for 2 years, and nobody noticed. They just thought I don't know what they thought was going on.
But you still did your teaching and your committeeing and your chairing and so on while you were ill.
Yeah, I did. But if you've got cancer, you've got to take your mind off it, haven't you? Distraction. My surgeon said to me when I said, was I going to have side effects from chemotherapy, Lisa, you're too busy to have side effects.
Well, that is a true definition of an optimist, I think. That's right.
With an optimistic surgeon.
With an optimistic surgeon. Well, I think you need optimism to deal with that. And the gong has
gone. There you go. Thank you, Stephen.